So the time keeps going by, and we're working our way through this period of time together for practice. So we're all picking up maybe little tidbits of knowledge, but hopefully also getting some kind of intuitive kind of understanding of what it is that, say, the teachings are pointing to. Having talked to many people, it seems that the teachings of self and not self seems to be the hardest thing to grasp compared to when we're using dukkha, often translated as suffering, and change, anicca. These two seem to sit well, you know, because it's quite observable in our day-to-day lives that we see the changing nature of things from the coarse to the refined. We can see babies, children, you know, people of different ages, and then we can see graveyards. So, you know, the big picture, there's a big process of change which is happening all the time. We can see it day to day, how we feel when we first open our eyes in the morning and, you know, go about our day and meeting with different experiences and meeting different people, and, you know, say we're hungry and then we eat and then we're full and then we do something, we do this, we do that, and then the day kind of winds down to an end and we can recognize the change. We can see the sun moving overhead as the day passes by. And then again, even more to the refined level, we can just see what happens within, say, like a 45-minute period of sitting quietly, the amount of mental activity that arises and passes away. But when we start to kind of question who it is that's experiencing these things, it can be a bit more tricky, because again, that sense of self is such a solidly kind of conditioned perception that we've lived with from birth. We're born and then we have children and friends and family around us who are just verifying more and more, like, you're a good little boy, you're this, you're that, and, you know, we just kind of take on that perception from the earliest days that we can remember. Yeah, when we start to get more and more kind of like, say, into practice and we start hearing, you know, wisdom teachings, of course it becomes a bit confusing or maybe not so intuitive to start, you know, questioning what it is that's having this experience. In the forest monasteries in Thailand, if you look through our chanting book even, there's a lot of pointing to this body and, say, to themes such as death. That's what Ajahn Amaro whispered earlier when we went by to see him. He was planning on talking about death today, but not that necessarily means I'm going to talk about death, but that was part of his idea for the day. But in our circles in the monasteries in Thailand, we're often reflecting on the coarse things, to the body, and the body is that thing which changes, and we can observe it. It's a lot more solid than the mind. The mind is obviously a little more slippery to get a hold of, especially if it's, say, untrained and just whirling here, there, and everywhere. It's not really a kind of sustainable practice, you know, from the get-go. So we have all these encouragements, you know, from the tradition to, you know, contemplate the body and contemplate the nature of the body and the destination of the body. Death is often kind of like the alarm bell that starts ringing for us when, say, we have close ones who die, or even if we just see, you know, like a dead cat or, you know, dead animal on the road, if you just kind of stop for a second and actually look at it, you know, rather than, say, look away, and, you know, you see like a live cat and then you see a dead cat, and, you know, what's the difference? And, you know, what is it that has that life faculty and running around? And we can easily project that there's a little self in that one, but the little self is, say, disappeared from the cat that's on the road. In the West, death is more kind of tucked away, hidden away. You know, when you die, you're quickly kind of shuffled off to a, you know, it's like a morgue or something, and then they put on, like, they dress people up like they're going to a party or they're going to a wedding or something. They put on nice clothes and they do makeup and whatnot. But say here in India, you know, if we go and have a look at some of these, you know, the burning piles that they have in, say, Varanasi and these places, it's a lot more raw and in your face. And, you know, for a Westerner, there's something intriguing about that. In Thailand, we were often invited to go to autopsies too, also to look at bodies This sounds completely strange. Ajahn Amaro was talking about writing all these enthusiastic letters home to his family about what he was up to. And, you know, you write to your mom and say, oh, you know, today I went to an autopsy and saw somebody get cut up and looked inside of his body. It doesn't really sit well. And in many contexts, it is kind of strange. But in this endeavor to kind of look at reality, you know, say as it is, and really have a look at what it is that we often take to be ourselves, which is, you know, this very body. You know, we say, look in the mirror, there we are, and it's this thing that we're kind of inside of, or seemingly inside of, and so easy that we can just assume that, you know, this is me, this is myself. But the practice of, say, reflecting on these things like death and, say, body contemplation, it's quite a valuable skill. And, you know, many teachers say that this practice alone can, you know, kind of get you well on your way to understanding and recognizing Nibbana. Again, it's a useful object to use because it is so solid and so, you know, tangible, say, compared to the mind. We can reflect on say, the body and how we look after it, we care for it, but it's still kind of like doing what it needs to do. All these, like, say, involuntary movements that it does, and say the heart is beating, you know, there's certainly the feeling of me inside. I'm not pumping my heart, I'm not growing my bones, I'm not firing off these electrons in my brain to be able to speak in English. You know, these things are just kind of happening by course of nature. But again, since this is the perception we've been, you know, going along with for so long, you know, it's a bit challenging to start to kind of question it. So the way that we would question it and say, use this as a practice, you know, even when we become novices in the Theravadan tradition, part of the ordination ceremony itself is just the five body parts, the five that are visible. The upajaya will say these and we repeat it back. So the hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. So you hear about all these meditation techniques in the world of Buddhism, and these five don't really get much mentioned. However, when you come to ordination, you know, it's right there in the ceremony. So clearly, you know, the Buddha was pointing to something that's very obvious here and now to kind of use as like your reflective tool, you know, as you go about your life. And it's not like, you know, you don't have to get all heady about it and feel like you just have to repeat the mantra over and over and over again, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, like, you know, taking on as a technique. But just kind of watch, you know, through the day how we take these things to be us, but how easily it is we can discard it and get rid of these parts of our body which are unfavorable. But then, you know, like, where do we draw the line? Say our nails are getting longer, we can easily look at your thumb and clip the nail, and you can see it go into the trash bin and say, oh no, that was just my nail now, and now it's gone. You know, we can cut our hair, we can, you know, pull out a tooth, and we can then see it, you know, that's my tooth, and we don't really kind of worry about throwing it away. But then the idea of dying all becomes scary. You know, when we think, when we have to let go of this whole thing at once, why does that all of a sudden become threatening? You know, if you were to imagine yourself sitting there, people who've worked in, like, say, like a wood shop or around power tools, you know, you can cut off a finger and you can still have that sense that, oh, right, here I am, but there's my finger. And it's no longer on me, but it's okay, I'm still here. And then we can cut off our hand and we can, you know, be this person that has no hand. And then you can kind of see where this is going. You can pull off your arms, but no, it's okay, I'm still here, but, you know, the arm's over there, but I'm still here. And then cut off your legs, and you've still got this, you know, feeling that you're bobbing around. And there's a joke. No, I won't say it. You know, as I was kind of referring to, kind of like in that guided meditation, it does kind of all come back to it. As long as the head is intact, you know, then everything's okay. Then I still exist, because again, we're experiencing most of our conscious life through this area of the. Of experience, I guess. But, like, yeah, these little ways of, like, you know, really reflecting what these themes of death, they can seem quite, confrontational. And obviously, you know, for a reason, there's a reason, you know, the Buddha kind of made us recognize this, because it just challenges it challenges that that sense of self. And when we die, we have when this body dies, there's a feeling that, you know, say the light goes out, or that's the end of my life. But we still have the other faculties of mind, and, you know, what actually happens at the moment of death, and all the talk about rebirth and on, like, we really don't know. We can have our ideas and opinions about it all. But then you're just kind of, again, kind of stuck in kind of concepts and whatnot. So just as I was, you know, trying to say, where is the self in the experience? You know, we can just use the basic practice. And, you know, I say basic as though it's like easy, like the building blocks or, you know, the ABCs of Buddhism. But, you know, it's quite a profound kind of avenue or gate into, you know, inquiring into the, say, selfless nature of the khandhas. And, you know, in the Satipatthana Sutta as well, it starts off talking about the body. Obviously, we have to use some kind of thinking. And often, in, you know, when we think about practice and meditation, you know, we're absent of thought, or we're just blank. But, you know, our minds do things. They think about things. And it's using these kinds of teachings and reflections to kind of nudge our attention into certain areas. And so, again, using the breath, for example, seems to be a universally accepted kind of method. But that's also happening, say, within the body. You can feel the air, you know, coming in through the nose and going out through the nose. And, you know, questioning and reflecting, like, who is it that's breathing? You know, who is it that's, like, beating a heart, or whatever kind of part of the body is getting our attention. So this is a practice that I've found useful over my time practicing in this tradition. And I'm not sure, you know, what, you know, Ajahn Amaro's plan was to talk about death or this or that, but it just seemed like a meaningful thing to kind of share, as far as you know, different ways that we can kind of experiment and just play with practice. You know, so many times we can just get stuck into you know, into techniques, or, like, you know, the Ajahn said do this, so if I just do 126 hours of this, you know, I'll kind of have this big moment of awakening. And you know, we can kind of get trapped into these ideas of practice that may or may not you know, bring us to you know, recognizing, you know, Nibbana. So, you know, that's why it's nice, you know, for myself, just to pepper little, you know, different strategies or kind of fun ways to, you know, experiment with practice, and, you know, really kind of invite people to make it your own, make practice, you know, something that you kind of gel with or you vibe with. And I used to kind of play a little bit of music, and, you know, there's the kind of the standard techniques of learning, you know, scales and tempos and beats and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, the real fun is when we kind of, you get together with some friends and you just turn on the amplifiers and have a jam session, and it, you know, kind of all, it all kind of grooves. So, you know, of course you're starting with a basic of understanding techniques and whatever, but, you know, one then, you know, it can make it kind of more interesting, or, yeah, just more creative. To kind of get a sense of if it's working or not, is your heart cool? You know, does whatever it is that you're doing, does it cool the mind, or does it agitate the mind? You know, practices that we've been hearing about, say, the sound of silence or anapanasati or, you know, whatever technique it is. You know, if this is leading the mind to coolness, you know, rather than agitation, then obviously it's, you know, a technique that you can kind of use to kind of aid your exploration of consciousness, because again, it's not just doing something over and over and over and over and over again that will magically, you know, pop or whatever, but it just helps to kind of, like, lay the groundwork to like lay the conditions, just like planting seeds, you know, for that moment of recognition to arise. And that recognition is looking and then seeing into the kind of nature of change, into the, what, you know, the Buddha was talking about when he referred to dukkha, and these aspects of, like, you know, the selflessness of, say, the body, feelings, sankharas, perceptions, and sense consciousness.